the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison.
Are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to College Football Country. My name is Josh Parcell, the founder of College Football Country, CFBCountry.com. Thank you guys so much for listening. What a fantastic show we have for you today. Gardner Minshew, the quarterback of Washington State, who led the Cougars to that thrilling 34-20 win up in the Palouse on Saturday night against the Ducks. He will join me for a few minutes before Reese Davis, who was also in the Palouse on Saturday night for that 34-20 win. As the host of College Game Day, he'll join me as well for two segments, and Reese will talk about all sorts of stuff about his career, how he got to become the host of College Game Day, whether he ever wanted to host College Game Day, and some advice for young broadcasters as well. It's a really fun conversation, really get to peek behind the curtain of what life is like at one of the most fun jobs in all of sports broadcasting. And maybe I got a little selfish as well with some of the questions, trying to learn a little bit about how he does what he does. But it's a fantastic interview start to finish, and it ends with some of the funniest off-camera Lee Corso moments that you probably have never heard before. So stick around for that. Right now we're going to get to Gardner Minshew again, the Washington State quarterback, transferred from East Carolina last season and now is leading the Cougars on the path to a potential Pac-12 North title after that win over Oregon on Saturday night. Gardner threw four touchdowns in that game. Again, the final was 34-20. So Gardner joins me first. Here's that interview with Gardner Minshew. And now I welcome back to College Football Country, WFNZ, Gardner Minshew, quarterback from Washington State. And a thrilling, thrilling victory for the Cougars last week, 34-20 up in Pullman. Gardner, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I bet you're doing great. I don't think I'm doing as well as you are right now. I mean, just describe to me what the last three, 4 days have been like for you and your world.
Yep. Saturday, it was truly one of the best college football experiences I think I've seen, you know, firsthand or seen anybody have. From you know, in the morning, all the fans we had a game day. They kept it going all day. You know, Martin Stadium was rocking all night. Then they stormed the field, and it was truly just, it was an incredible experience.
Did that fuel you, the energy? Because I'm sure it wasn't just Saturday. I mean, it was all week long, the anticipation of College Game Day being on campus and the national spotlight being on you and your team. How hard was it for you to avoid the distraction and at least channel that in a way that was positive for you guys?
Exactly. That's right. I mean, you want to kind of not listen to the noise, as Coach Leach calls it, but you kind of use that stage to kind of fuel you up a little bit. It should get you excited that you're playing on such a big stage. But you just can't let it distract you. You have to let it fuel you.
You know, I'll be honest, Gardner, I saw some pictures after the game. One was on Drew Bledsoe's Instagram. Your hand is all bloodied up. Was that real blood, or were you faking that for the camera for the Instagram likes?
Yes, that was definitely staged. Appreciate Drew Bledsoe for being a part of the con we pulled. That was great.
You know, Drew Bledsoe is obviously a legend at Washington State, and you've had, you know, some great quarterbacks as well. Ryan Leaf, of course, Jason Guest have been terrific quarterback play at Washington State for years now. You know, where do you talk to any of those guys? Do you talk to Drew, and how do you feel like the legacy of Washington State's quarterback stacks up with some of the other programs around the country?
That's right. Washington State has a quarterback legacy that goes way back, you know, starting with, you know, one of the first I know, at least, is Jack Thompson. He's always around. I talked to him a good bit. Just outstanding guy, great ambassador for the university. And then, you know, the other guys I've talked to, Ryan Leaf and Drew Bledsoe's son. He's on the team. So I've gotten to know them pretty well. And then got to know Jason Guesser as well, too. All great guys. And it's really special to be a part of a place that has such rich history at this position.
You know, I know you guys are controlling what you can control, and all you can do is go out every week and play well and give me all the cliches you want about just going a game at a time. You guys did jump to 14 this week in the polls. If you win out, you're obviously going to have a great chance to make the playoff. But without getting too far ahead of ourselves, do you feel like you guys are getting the appropriate amount of respect for what you've accomplished so far this season? You ranked 14th in the polls this week.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't really care about any of that. I mean, we're just trying to get better. We still got a lot of things we got to fix. And, you know, hopefully if we continue to do that by the end of the year, you know, we'll be in a position where we can go to those bowl games that we want to go to.
You know, what you talked about Mike Leach a minute ago and him talking about blocking out the noise. He makes a lot of noise himself. I just want to know, what the heck is it like being around that guy day to day? What's the weirdest thing Mike Leach has ever said to you?
Oh, weirdest thing. I got no clue. But, you know, one of the cool things is, you know, he really treats everybody the same, whether he's talking to the media, talking to us. You know, he's genuine as all get out. You know, he's going to be him. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of guys can really appreciate that.
Talk to me about some of the differences between him and any other coach you've had. Because we sit here in the media and we see him in his press conferences, and he's a kooky guy. But when he's coaching football, when he's out there on the practice field or even on game day, you know, kind of compare and contrast him to some of, not specifically other coaches you've had in the past, but just what is he like that's maybe different than what you've been used to before you got to Washington State?
Yeah, I think one of the best things he does is he just simplifies things very well. You know, he doesn't cloud everything up with, you know, thinking about too much stuff. You know, he simplifies the offense where we're better at what we do than they are at what they do. And that's his whole philosophy. And then, you know, just, you know, some of his things about, you know, we got to be the most excited to play. We got to be a team. And, you know, just, you know, some of the things that he says is really great.
You know, Washington State, since Mike Leach took over, has been building and building, and they've had some pretty solid teams. Are you confident you guys can get that job done? How important would it be for you to be that first team under Mike Leach to really, truly get them to a point where they are nationally recognized as a top program? Because they certainly seem like they're knocking on the doorstep, and last week was a big step in that direction. But, you know, how important is it for you to be a part of that?
Yeah, well, he's won 9 games twice here. Yeah, and you know, we definitely have high goals here. You know, he has definitely changed the expectation, and you know, we want to be considered with one of the elite programs in the country, and I think we, you know, have an opportunity to do it. And we just have to continue to work, continue to get better.
What do you see in Stanford this weekend? This obviously, you know, not an easy game to follow up such an emotional victory against Oregon, but what's your scouting report of the Cardinal? What do you guys have to do to win that game?
Yeah, they're a great team. We got to go into their place, take it to them. They're going to be very physical, very well coached. And, you know, they present, you know, a huge challenge. And it's, I think, one of the biggest challenges for us also is turning the page from last week. You know, we got to get over that. Oregon's done and behind us. We're all on Stanford now, and we have a really good team that we're about to have to play.
And, you know, finally here, I know you probably have some role models at quarterback. Maybe Drew Bledsoe is one of them, maybe some guys in the NFL. But I really want to know who you model your mustache after, because I'm looking at your Twitter page here. You're clean cut on the face. So this mustache is a relatively new thing. Who inspired you to have the mustache? Do you have any role models? Maybe it's Tom Selleck. Is it Hulk Hogan? Who is your role model in the mustache world?
Oh, it's definitely Burt Reynolds. God rest his soul.
Yeah.
I was a big Smokey and the Bandit guy as a kid growing up, had the VHS. Yeah, so definitely the Bandit. He was always, you know, he set the bar high, and I'm just trying to do my best to emulate that.
Now, has this made you more popular with the co-eds in Pullman, less popular? Do you care?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd say the biggest thing is it makes me very recognizable. you know, the mustache kind of sticks out. And I get recognized a good bit up here. But, you know, it's just a testament to, you know, how good our fans are. They're all over Pullman. And, you know, just love playing for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a great fan base. It was such an awesome scene on Saturday, seeing Old Crimson flying all over the place for game day. It's got to be such a cool experience for you. Real happy for you guys and your success. And, of course, it's not over yet. You guys have a lot to play for still. You got Stanford, of course, this weekend, and some big games in the conference the rest of the way. Gardner, thanks so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon. Best of luck the rest of the way.
Sounds good. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. And now I am so thrilled to welcome on the host of College Game Day, Reese Davis, to the College Football Country Podcast. Reese, this is an honor. I know I had Bear on last week, so you're the second best guest we've had this season, but I hopefully you can settle for that. Is that okay?
No, I'm not going to settle for it, so I'll be seeing you later, Josh. I'm not talking if I'm second best.
Okay, fine. I'll put you ahead of Bear. That's fine. I think he can live with that.
I'm just kidding. Bear, he might have talked to you while he and I were riding to Pullman last week. So, yeah, he's a great guy, brings a ton to the show, as you know, not only from his gambling savvy, but his Rain Man-esque recollection of things in college football. So it's I will begrudgingly take the number two spot behind Bear.
Yeah, I love Bear, and he's been a great friend of the podcast for a while. But so excited to have you on. And you know, a lot of times I bring our guests on and we talk about whatever's going on this weekend. We talk about Alabama for the eighth straight week and whatever else. But honestly, I kind of want to get a different perspective from you here. You know, being a part of College Game Day now for a few years, and so many people who I know listen to my podcast are, you know, aspiring broadcasters. I got a lot of younger people who I'm sure look up to you. And I thought to get a peek behind the curtain of what life is like for you, you're doing a cool thing now where every week you're on Instagram or on Twitter, you're posting some behind the scenes videos. You're giving people a little bit of a look into what it's like on a day-to-day basis for you getting ready for the show. So in as concise as you can be, kind of walk me through what a typical week is like for you getting ready for that week's episode of College Game Day.
I think the easiest way to describe it, Josh, is that it's constant. And now it's a labor of love. I love the sport. I think I have the best job in television, being able to talk about it and go to all of these great places. But we really start talking about the next week's show on Saturday afternoon. Now, some of those conversations may be casual and text in nature, but it starts picking up by Sunday. And by Monday morning, the producer, Jim Guerrero, and I are on the phone for quite a period of time. And then we have a group of us that get together and talk over some ideas on Tuesdays. And, all the time before, you're talking to people and you're reading everything you can and you're formulating your ideas. And maybe you're going back to watch tape of a game maybe you didn't see as much of. You know, there are all those types of things that go into trying to nobody can know and see every little thing that happened in every game or even every big game, but we do our best to be as in touch and informed as we possibly can and try to put it all together and give each idea the proper amount of time and all of that kind of stuff. You mentioned the social media aspect. I did a thing that it surprised me how well received it was. The night before, Friday night, in a hotel room, I think it was at Michigan. And I just sort of did a little minute video and said, you know, here are all the notes I've compiled this week. Here's the rundown. Here are the graphics. Here are the tape, because I go through and look at every piece of tape that's going to be in the show. You know, and I showed them a little clip of that on the computer. There was a shot of David Pollack back when he was a heavy defensive lineman instead of a svelte wide receiver looking dude. And, so I just tried to give him a little insight into what goes on. And hopefully, I think people are interested in that. I think there's a misconception sometimes that because we know and like the sport that we just kind of roll out there and start talking, and it's not really that way.
Yeah, and I probably watched that video about 50 times, give or take, because I mean, every time I watched it, there was something new. I was kind of trying to peek at your notes, and it is. I think you're right. I mean, people take for granted, I think, the amount of preparation that you put into it and the amount of notes you have to be prepared for. One of the things that always blew my mind, I mean, coming from ESPN and, you know, understanding how to produce a studio show is one thing, but College Game Day is just on, it's such another level it is a technically, if you want to call it a studio show, it's formatted like one, but at the same time, you've got so many moving parts. You're obviously not in a studio. And you even said in that video, I think it was in that video that you just talked about, you know, you guys don't have a teleprompter. I mean, it is so different. And that to me is the most impressive part of it all. So how do you guys kind of navigate, you know, preparing for that without a prompter, just in terms of getting in and out of breaks and the open that you have? I'm sure that's probably scripted at the beginning of the show. You know, how tough is it sometimes? Do you ever feel like have you ever felt like you needed one?
No. I think it's used one in so long. I mean, I didn't use one on all those years in the studio with Mark and Lou either. I mean, I just, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. I think that there are people who say, you know, he's a prompter jockey. He reads the glass. There's nothing wrong with a teleprompter. There's still skill in writing. I mean, Dan and Keith used teleprompters in SportsCenter. They were brilliant because their writing was brilliant and the delivery was. But I think what happens in shows like ours is if you script everything, you miss the opportunity for great moments. And our show is largely based around conversation. And I also think that analysts who aren't accustomed to a teleprompter or whatever, if they see words on the screen, then they're wondering, even on a subconscious level, no matter how experienced, do I need to wait and let that person say whatever's on the screen? And you eliminate all of that because we try very hard to be as thoroughly prepared as we can for a conversation and to be able to react in the moment. I don't know what Kirk's going to say or what Desmond's going to say, and I might have a different take, or I might need to challenge them on something or whatever it might be. And if you're so intricately scripted that you are waiting to get to the next part of the script, then you lose those moments. The other thing that it would do is just, you mentioned, it's sort of a hybrid of a studio show and a live event.
Right.
And there are things going on in the crowd you want to capture. And, you know, things that happen that maybe you need to let go a little bit. And, you know, things may pop up. We may decide to go to Bear when it's not necessarily in the rundown to go to Bear then. You know, all of those types of things, I think, that make it better for the show not to use a prompter. And, you know, I guess there's probably some sort of, in all honesty, there's some sort of pride that goes along with saying, well, I can handle this and know this without a prompter. The only time that I would say that I wouldn't ever say you miss it, because I'm accustomed to not having it. If you have a story that is heavy in legal ease, you know, or something that has to be precise. And now that I still write. I write a lot of stuff because I know what I want to say. I never deliver it just as I wrote it. But in certain instances, maybe there's a legality or something that you really need to get right. Maybe in that instance, you'd make sure you bat 1,000 or come closer to making sure you bat 1,000 if you had one. But more times than not, if you just take your time and know what you want to say, you'll be fine.
You know, when you took over for Chris a couple years ago, obviously huge shoes to fill. And I'm sure the advice that people gave you was to be yourself. And that's largely what you've been. In your mind, when you took over, you know, was there anything that you wanted to kind of continue from what Chris did to make the show so successful? And were there things that you wanted to make your own? And how do you feel now a couple years into it that that's gone?
Well, I'm 4 years into it now, and it's kind of hard to say but without sounding, you know, like a fathead or something, but I've been doing this a long time. I mean, my wife and I sort of laughed and joked about this, and yeah, big overnight sensation, 20 some odd years in the making, you know, when I was named host of Game Day, I was pretty confident in my abilities, and I was certainly confident in my knowledge of the sport. What had to come along and what you did want to continue was the chemistry that they had on the set when Chris was a host. Now, he and I are, I think there might be some similarities, but I think in personality, in a lot of ways, we're different. That's neither good nor bad. We just, you know, just everybody's a little different in personality. And when you bring a different personality into the mix, then you have to see how the chemistry goes. The thing that I think was an advantage is that I had worked individually with everyone on the set in some capacity. I'd done games and some shows, you know, studio type shows with Kirk, I hadn't done as much with Lee over the years, but I'd done the different shows here and there with Lee. Desmond and I, when he first started, had worked in the studio together, and David and I called games together for several years, and David and I were already very close. So I had all of these individual relationships, but the thing that we hadn't done that had to be cultivated was the chemistry as a group. And I think that came along pretty quickly. I think that, I tried to be very cognizant of not coming in and like being overbearing and things that I might think or think that need to be done with the show. I didn't want to shy away from being a leader, and because a good host has to lead a show. If he doesn't, he's not doing his job. But at the same time, that show was so established that, you know, I didn't need to go in and start, you know, throwing a hammer down and saying, I think we should do everything this way and all of that stuff. So I tried to give everybody room, tried to let the chemistry grow as a group. And I think we've been pretty successful at that up to this point.
You talked about it being a 20-year in the making kind of process, and you're right. I mean, you were at ESPN for so long before you got Game Day, and I know you hear from so many people, some younger people, aspiring broadcasters, people who say, how can I get into your shoes one day, or just advice on getting into the business in general. And I think one of the things that a lot of people that I've come across, and I think I was guilty of this myself for a long time, and maybe I still am, is just the idea of patience. And the idea of understanding that there is only one Chris Fowler, there is only one seat up there on that College Game Day set that is, you know, up for the taking. And, you know, was there any point, I don't want to say frustrated, but what was your mindset? I'm sure at what point did you say, this is the job I really want? And how did you kind of square yourself with the patience of understanding that it's really not up to you when that time comes?
Well, I think the thing is, Josh, is that I didn't necessarily aspire to host Game Day. And I say that with all honesty. Now, I do think that it's the best job in television, particularly for someone like me who loves the sport. But I loved the studio also. Yeah. Being at the nerve center of a College Football Saturday, when for most of my tenure in the studio, we had virtually every game, save a Notre Dame game and a CBS SEC game. Now that the landscape's changed a little bit in the last few years, but for most of my time in the studio, we had virtually everything. And if we didn't have it, the people at home were relying on us to show it to you in highlight shows and College Football Final. So I loved all of those things, but you know, there's a business aspect of what we do. And when my contract was coming to an end, my agent and I, you know, talked about what I wanted, and what I wanted was the most prominent role possible in college football. Now, what did that mean? That was up for ESPN or potentially others right on the outside to decide whether they wanted to offer me something internally or externally. And I wanted to be involved in the sport. I wanted it at the highest level I possibly could. ESPN certainly made the most sense because we had the college football playoff, and because of my dedication and loyalty to the place where I've worked for now 23 and a half years. So that was the hope, but it was not aimed at solely getting Game Day. It was, what can we do that puts me in the most prominent position I can be in? And as it turns out, circumstances dictated that, as the previous year, Chris had done both and calling the game and then doing Game Day. And as it worked out, I think that, you know, that was an opportunity there. And so it worked out that way. But I don't want it to be perceived, because it wasn't the case, that, you know, I've been sitting in my role pining away for Game Day for the last, you know, how many ever years prior to getting it. It wasn't that way at all. I had great respect for the show and great respect for Chris, who's an immense talent. But, you know, I wasn't sitting there, angling to get that seat, or wondering when he was going to move on or anything like that. It was really just what's the best opportunity available for me. And fortunately, there were some, there were good opportunities available, and I was fortunate enough to be able to get the best.
I'm interested to get your thought on this too, because I'm 28, been in the business now for what, 6 years, mostly producer, obviously had on-air aspirations for a long time. It was since I was 10, I wanted Chris's job. And, you know, now with, I say this in the most respectful way possible, I want your job one day. I mean,
well,
not the first person to tell
you
that.
I won't last forever. The only guarantee that I can give you, what Fowler, I think, hosted it for 25 years. I doubt I make 25. I mean, I'm 52 years old, so I'm in year number four. So I would be in my mid 70s by then. I sort of doubt I ring up 25. So that thing will come up before 25 years. So don't worry about that.
Well, sitting
but
with Pollock every week will age
your breath,
you quickly.
Because I don't want to let it go anytime soon either.
I don't think you will. Well, I don't know if I'm quite ready for the task yet. But I mean, one day, that's obviously the goal. And there's a lot of people in my shoes, and a lot of people who have big aspirations. And the way the media landscape has changed, and something that I've been told by a lot of people is, you know, you need to, the days of the old traditional studio show and the old anchor that plays it straight, those guys are going by the wayside, and the future is in opinion, and the future is in big commentary. And you saw a shift in that for several years, both at ESPN and outside of ESPN. But at the end of the day, there are still guys who are able to do what you do, and it takes such an immense talent to be able to do it. Two-part question on that. One, do you think your career would look different if you were, let's say, 28 years old now? How differently do you think your career would have unfolded? Would it be any different? And then secondly, what do you think the future of game day looks like 10, 15 years from now? Is it the same show as it is now, or do you think it changes?
Well, I'll answer the second part first, because I think that's an easier question to answer. I've challenged everybody on our group and challenged myself during the off season to keep our show fresh. And by that, I mean, this show has been so successful for a number of years that the foundation is something that does not need to be shaken. It doesn't need to be, if it were a car, it doesn't need an overhaul, but you certainly have to make sure that the oil continues to be changed and that the tires are fresh and ready to go. So that means that you do things a little differently, that we talk all the time. Every week we go through the rundown and we say, where are the surprises? Where are the memorable moments? Let's make sure that we're not formulaic. Have we done this the last 2 weeks in this segment? You know, but just now there are different games. Let's make sure we don't do that. I use the word fresh mm-hmm. all the time, and our goal is to keep the show fresh. So I think that's one of the reasons you know, and they did. I don't want to make it sound as if I started doing this and they, hey, we never thought about keeping it fresh before. I think that's one of the things that Lee Fitting, who was the producer for a long time of the show and sort of the father of the growth of Game Day, and Chris and Kirk, who much like my partnership with Jay Billis in basketball, is like Kirk and Jay are both unique. Although Jay would yell at me because there are no gradations of unique. You're either unique or you're not. But those two guys are highly unusual in that they are analysts who see and know everything. And I don't mean about their sport. I'm talking about the show. They have great feel. And that's an unbelievable asset and partnership for a host to have. Then you have a brilliant producer like Fitting was for a number of years. And you have a great talent like Chris, who is hosting it, who also sees the big picture and the need to keep things fresh. I think all of those types of things, there can be the best little example, when we take ideas from anywhere, and it's sort of evolved into just something that I'm the only one that's done it. Maybe I'm the only one dumb enough to do it. But, you know, Rinaldi suggested a couple of years ago, I solicited ideas from everyone. I said, we may not use any of them. We may use 12 of them. I said, give me some ideas of something fresh, unique, something we haven't done. It can be little bitty things, it can be big things. One of the things that Tom sent in his list was the idea of the translator. He said, maybe we'll translate coach speak and each of us do it different weeks. Well, I'm the only one that's done it, but I had a lot of fun with it. You know, I kind of poked fun at Harbaugh and D'Antonio last week, using it. You know, I did Saban. Butch Jones is, I'm very friendly with Butch, and you know, I got a lot of reaction on Twitter saying, oh, you know, Davis put him in a body bag. I didn't mean that. I was having fun with him, you know, because he was trying to cover up an injury or whatever it was, you know, during a difficult time in Tennessee. And, you know, I think that those things like that are different. You have to be careful not to overuse them. If we're not doing one this week, there wasn't anything that jumped out at me. You try to make sure that things don't become tired, that they become fresh, and you always look for new ideas. As to the other part of your question, I don't know how differently it would look if I were 28 instead of 52. I would think not much, and that might surprise you a little bit, because I do think that I'm more empowered to share an opinion now, which, you know, I did on UCF on Saturday, which I've done on different times. But the thing about being a host, to me, at least particularly in the types of shows that I host, you need to be judicious and you need to mean it. You know, you don't need to come out and have a hot take on every issue, you know?
Right.
But the ones that you feel strongly about, you should feel empowered to share those. You also need to maintain the in the forefront of your mind the best thing for the show. Now, there are times when, you know, when maybe I have a really, really strong opinion on something and I'm dying lousy to get it out there. But for whatever reason, the show has – the conversation is in such a place, or maybe – maybe it's become too tense between two of your analysts, or maybe it's opening up a can of worms that don't need to be opened, or that doesn't need to be opened, you know, at that particular moment in the show. You have to have some discipline in that. You have to be judicious in when you share it, but I think you should feel empowered to share it. And that's kind of how I've approached it right now. And I think the most important thing for a broadcaster is not to be something that's outside your comfort zone. There was a great newscaster when I worked in Flint, Michigan, that was in Detroit. I'd never heard of him before this, but I found out some things about him later, named Bill Bonds. And he was like the quintessential, you know, 70s and 80s guy, high rolling newscaster, a little, you know, off the field issue from time to time, but, you know, kind of really, beloved in the community, you know, because he was kind of a swinger kind of guy. And when I noticed him first, he was doing a reader one night and his back started itching. So he just leaned toward the camera and started scratching it and kept talking and would occasionally in the middle of his newscast go, "Prompter, keep up with me here," like that. And he would just kind of go on. He was himself. And I read something that he said one time that I think is really smart for hosts. He said, "You can't be a phony, but you need to be a slightly exaggerated version of yourself." Mm-hmm. Because, you know, just kind of sitting here chatting might not be terribly compelling, but as long as it's authentic and it might accentuate some areas of your personality, your takes or whatever it might be, I think those people have the most staying power in the business and come off as more authentic.
Authenticity is such an important thing, and sometimes it takes time to develop that too. I mean, sometimes you're taught a certain way, or you look at other people. I've had this happen to me plenty of times where, you know, I'll finish a radio show or a podcast or do something for TV, and I'm like, was I being myself or was I trying to be somebody else? And that can be tough when you're young and you're still trying to learn, you know, what is your true voice and how you develop that. It's not easy.
When I was your age, or a little bit, maybe a year older, was when I got to ESPN. And that was in the heyday of the Dan and Keith era. It was even, you know, prior to Rich and Stu kind of working that show. And there was enormous implied pressure to have the next great catchphrase. And as you're alluding to, I fell victim to that many times. You know, some had a short lifespan and were okay, and some were, you know, I pulled a groin because I was trying too hard. And, you know, but there was pressure. That was viewed at the time, at least by me, and really I think by the reaction that you got, it was viewed as the gateway to success. And when I can't tell you there was a show or a moment when I did this, but when I finally decided I'm not a funny guy, but I can be funny. There's a difference.
Yep.
You know, I can say something that anybody, most anybody can, you know, but I can say something that's funny, but I'm not a funny guy like Keith or like Scott Van Pelt or, you know, somebody like that who's just a naturally humorous guy and has a gift for that. I can occasionally say something that I find amusing. And when I became comfortable enough to approach it, like, if I think it's funny enough, I'm going to say it. But I'm not going to think, what can I say here that will be funny or catchy or will, you know, be the next great catchphrase. When I stopped worrying about that and just, you know, if something popped in my head organically that I thought was funny, I would say it. And, you know, are you going to make mistakes sometimes doing it? Yeah, sure you will. But for the most part, I think that's a pretty good governor and a pretty good guide is if you think it's funny, say it, but don't pull a groin, you know, trying to be funny.
Exactly. Try not to pull too many and you might survive. Well, I could talk to you forever. I have to ask you one more question before we get out of here. I would be remiss not to ask you for a great Lee Corso behind the scenes story that maybe we haven't heard before. Because nobody has spent more time with Lee than you and Kirk and Dez and those guys over the last few years. So I know it's only been a few years with Lee, but do you have anything from behind the scenes that you might want to let the listeners in on about Lee Corso?
I've got two that I tell often, maybe in the interest of time. I'll tell one, and then if you want the other one, I'll give it to you. Last year at Penn State, you know, I always look for something that kind of captures the essence of the place, that kind of riles up the crowd for the scene set, which is what we call the very first thing when you come on. So as you probably know, at Penn State, usually at some point during the game, the student section will start chanting, "We want the Lion." And the Lion mascot will go to the student section and they will body surf him, pass him all the way to the top of Beaver Stadium. So I got the idea that, you know, maybe we come on instead of the "We are Penn State" that everybody's expecting. Maybe we go "We want the Lion" and we have the Lion jump into the crowd and they surf him back, you know, to Old Main, which is the building where our set was. And, you know, I think that's a pretty good idea to sort of casually mention it to Herb Street. And he says, "Hey, what if we get LC to do it?" And I said, "That'd be great." So you want me to ask him? I said, "Oh, no, I'll ask him." I said, "It's my deal, but your idea, I'll ask him." And I told him, "LC, you know, I have this idea. Kirk and I were talking. He said, it'd be great if you do it. Would you do it?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'll do it. So this is Friday morning. So as the day goes on, I start getting more and more nervous about this. Because look, LC is in great physical condition. All you have to do is watch him run up and down the sideline, you know, during the game when he's watching the game, try to keep up with him, realize he's in great shape. But, you know, I am thinking about, boy, what if they don't put him down? They pass him all the way back. We get in, you know, get into a situation where, you know, he's a little scrambling to get back while coming to your sit days, playing, you know, in the A's, and, you know, we put him in a bad spot. So, what if he's in great shape. I wouldn't want him to drop him, whole thing. So I talked to security, and we have a great security team that goes with us. I said, "Look, if there is any issue whatsoever," I said, "not a problem." I said, "The Lion's going to do it. You know, just tell LC to come on back up. So just, you know, if you have any doubts, you have any worries, it's no big deal if he doesn't do it. We'll be fine without it." So fast forward to Saturday morning, he's down there getting excited, and the director gets in my ear and he goes, "Hey, RD, security's saying no go on this. They're worried you're going to drop him. Where are they going to put him down? That's just going to be, they lose control. They don't want it. They're saying no." I said, "No problem at all." I said, "Tell LC to come on back up here." They said, "You tell him." I opened him up. I said, "Hey, coach," I said, "look, security's a little worried about this. We're not going to do it. Just come on back up here to the set." To which, now we're 30 seconds from the show, to which LC responds, "Hell no, I'm doing it." I said, "All right then." So we came on, we want the Lion, you know, we want coach, and off he goes. And it was one of the cool moments there. It showed he understands as well as anyone. He says this a lot. He'll remind us, you know, it's important to do the XLs, all those types of things. Very important. You have to have your foundation of your show. But Coach often says, it's entertainment, sweetheart. Football is our vehicle. And, you know, nobody understands that, I think, better than he.
That is tremendous. They didn't drop him, thankfully.
They did not. No. He made it back for the A's. He was ready, and he killed it and had a great show.
That's fantastic. 9 a.m., I would trust the coordination of the student body more than I would maybe around 9 p.m. So it's still early. I feel like you could still trust those kids.
Yeah, they did a good job with him. They really did. It was really cool. He knows how to play the crowd, that's for sure.
That's awesome. I have time for the other one, unless you want to move and we can save it for another time.
No, I'll hit you with it right quick. This was actually the national championship game, Oregon and Ohio State. It was before I was officially hosting game day. But, you know, with Chris doing the game, I was hosting game day and the pregame stuff for the national championship game, Oregon and Ohio State. It was in Jerry World, and we'd spent most of our time in Fort Worth. And I don't know if you're familiar with the name Ed Bass, but Mr. Bass is a billionaire. He built the biosphere. He is totally responsible for – he's a philanthropist, a very generous man who is responsible for the rebuilding of Fort Worth. He's involved in the arts. He's Yale educated. He flies around on G4. He does all these wonderful things, you know. He's accomplished a ton in his life. He has often been listed among the 50 richest people in America. His daughter has occasionally worked for us in our production staff. And Mr. Bass was around a lot, and he had arranged for us to be at Sundance Square and a few different things. And so we're getting ready for the headgear pick between Oregon and Ohio State. And as I'm saying whatever I'm saying before we go to break, I kind of notice out of the corner of my eye, well, there's Mr. Bass, you know, true quintessential Fort Worth fashion, blue jeans, cowboy belt, big cowboy hat, and he had a giant garbage bag. And I was like, what's Mr. Bass doing with that garbage bag? And so we go to commercial break. We're getting ready for LC to put on the headgear, and here comes Mr. Bass onto the set carrying his garbage bag. And he comes around behind the set, and he gets down on the ground, and he is the carrier of the mascot head. He had asked if he could be involved. Now, here's a billionaire who you would think would want the camera time. He doesn't care about the camera time. Nobody knows it's him. He's down underneath the desk, grinning from ear to ear. And so when the time comes, and he says, give me that Brutus head. It was Mr. Bass who reached up and handed it to him, and LC puts it on. The Ohio State people go crazy, and we go off to the game. So the game's on the air and we're off, and Mr. Bass standing up and he's still just laughing, he's smiling. And of all the things he's accomplished, he goes, that might be the greatest thing I've ever done. And I was like, wow. This headgear moment resonates so much that the dude who has built Symphony Hall and rebuilt an entire city's downtown and rejuvenated an economy and built the biosphere and all these things, and handing Lee Corso the mascot head, was right, at least in that moment, ranked right at the top of his list of accomplishments.
Well, hopefully that didn't force Lee's ego to grow any bigger. I know Lee's a humble guy, so we don't want him getting a big head.
He's the best. He is the best.
That's fantastic. Well, like I said, Reese, you've been more than gracious with your time. That was fantastic. Really appreciate you. I know you're busy, so for you to come on means a lot, and thanks so much.
No, thanks for having me, Josh. Nice talking to you, and best of luck. All the success you want, with the exception of taking my job for several more years. I need it for a while.
I'll give you 10 or 20, and then we'll talk again.
All right, sounds like a deal.
All right, have a good one, Reese.